Thank you, Rabbi Goldberg. Thank you all for coming out. It's a funny angle, but I will do my best to kind of face like this, and I think we'll be great. It's really a pleasure seeing Rabbi Goldberg again as somebody who I did know when. He was a star then, too, but it's really exciting to see all the and to hear about all the wonderful things you're doing in Fort Lee and beyond. Thank you so much for hosting me, and it's good. Rabbi Goldberg was in L.A. previously, and he was able to invite me to come out to L.A. as a scholar in residence, but he warned me, by the time I get there for Shavuot, he'll already be here. So that was actually the transitional point, so it's good to reconnect actually and see you this time around, as opposed to communicate via 3,000 miles across the, across the nation. So the interaction of traditional and academic Bible study is my bag. That's what I like to talk about, and I was very delighted to hear that Rabbi Goldberg and Rabbi Charka. I want to thank him also. He's also a student of mine. That they were interested in this sort of line of business, because I think a lot of people out there are interested in this kind of discussion. We're speaking from an Jewish traditional point of view, we're thinking about it as God's word, and then we understand that there's a huge academic environment out there that doesn't share our point of view religiously, and very often they come up with radically different assumptions, and for the last 200 years there's been a lot of giving and taking. So this three-part series will cover three totally different arenas within this interaction. Tonight we're going to focus on Torah study and ancient Near Eastern scholarship. Next week we'll deal with the fact that there's an awful lot of contradictions in the Torah, and if, after all, God is revealing the whole thing, well, why are there so many contradictions anyway? That'll be next week, and then the final week will just be about how literary study can help us understand what are the moral messages that the Torah is trying to teach. So three different arenas, it'll be a little smorgasbord of hopefully very worthwhile learning that we'll be able to do together. So over to ancient Near Eastern scholarship. It actually, in the last 200 years, there was a history to how this worked. Here's the one sentence summary of 200 years of scholarship. That's what I like to do when you get an hour. And it works out better, so we could actually learn this way. The original scholars were all interested in proving the truth of the Bible. They got their spades out, they went into Israel, they went to other places, and they tried to prove that Tanakh was true. By and large, these were Bible-believing Christians who were involved in the industry. And that was their goal. The good news is, I'm at least somewhat sympathetic to what they were trying to do, albeit not fully, not the way that they did it, but somewhat sympathetic. The bad news is it's terrible scholarship to go that way, obviously, right? To actually try to dig underground and try to prove something before you look at the evidence, that's not good scholarship. You have to look at the evidence and then try to draw conclusions out of that. So then came a counter-reaction in the world of scholarship, which was inimical to this, trying to show that you should ignore Tanakh and just try to see what's underground, and to try to reconstruct history that way. Well, of course, to ignore the most important text from that era, namely Tanakh, and to focus only on artifacts, well, on the one hand, you're focusing on the artifacts better. On the other hand, you're ignoring a very important literary work, namely Tanakh, that has some bearing on real events that have occurred. So that was round two. Finally came round three. Not everybody in the academic world is up to round three yet, but that's where I think everybody should be, both traditionalists and non-traditionalists alike, which is, okay, these are different disciplines. How do we create a positive dialogue between the disciplines? Not where we're trying to prove this or that from archaeology, not where we're trying to disprove everything unless archaeology can corroborate it, but how do they work to corroborate one another in their own way, letting each one have its own discipline? That's what tonight is going to be. I'm going to give you a textbook example of how we can use ancient Near Eastern scholarship, not to prove this or that, but simply as a tool, as one of our many tools in our toolbox. Without further ado, we have this great Tower of Babel story. It is only 9 verses long. That's pretty short, even by biblical standards. And if you're keeping score, if you know the region of the Torah that we're dealing with, it is the only story between Noah and Abraham. So I put my money on the fact that this has got to be a really important story. And what happens? Well, let's just read it together. I'm going to do the English, but you have the Hebrew right in front of you as well, okay? Everyone on earth had the same language and the same words. And they migrated from the east, and they came upon a valley in the land of Shinar and settled there. Shinar likely, although not necessarily, is the biblical way of saying what you and I would say, Sumeria. So it's one and the same. We're dealing with the place that, what city is this going to be, by the way? It's going to be Babylonia. We understand that there's the region Sumeria, and then Babylonia is the key story, the city involved in all of this. Okay, so these people are migrating, they go east, they find Shinar. They said to one another, verse 3, come, let us make bricks and burn them hard. Bricks serve them as stone, and bitumen serve them as mortar. Great, they got right to work building bricks. And they said, come, let us build us a city and a tower with its top in the sky, to make a name for ourselves. Else we shall be scattered all over the world. Okay, so they're building a city with a tower in it. And what's motivating them? You tell me. We just read it. So what's motivating them? Why are they doing this? It's hard work. Huh? They want to build a city. Okay, and why do they want to build the city? To make a name for themselves. Okay, and anything else?
Fear.
Fear of? Scattering. Okay, is anything unusual here? Or is this just like, okay, we want to hold the community together. And so the way to do it, of course, is to build on a plain, build a high tower, and that way, as we all know this drill, the center of town is where the real estate prices are the highest. And so the kids need to move out to the suburbs. Right? And slowly but surely, they move further and further away from the hub. How are we going to keep everybody in touch without an internet? Answer, build a tower. Very simple. That way, as people move further and further away, they can look up and see the tower for miles around, and they'll remember home. Beautiful. Anything terrible about that?
No.
Okay. Sounds like a reasonable thing that they're trying to do. Well, silly me, God doesn't think it's a reasonable thing to do. Right? Verse 5. The Lord came down to look at the city and tower that man had built, and the Lord said, if as one people with one language for all, this is how they have begun to act, then nothing that they may propose to do will be out of their reach. Oh no! I can't let them do this, because then there's no telling where this will stop. Well, for whatever reason, that very nice idea of having a building that people could look at suddenly turns out to be a divinely terrible idea. And so God has to do something about it, namely he invents French, right? And a whole bunch of other languages too. So God swoops in, verse 7, let us then go down and confound their speech there, so that they shall not understand one another's speech. Thus the Lord scattered them from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Suddenly they're all speaking different languages. That creates terrible havoc in schools. They were unable to communicate, and so the project was abandoned, and everybody moves to the countries where their languages were now spoken, and however that all works. Okay, this is why it was called Babel, because there the Lord confounded the speech. The Hebrew is Balal, right? So Balal is a wordplay on Babel. Confounded the speech of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. All right, so here goes. Ancient problem that we have over here, so let's focus on our ancient problem. Okay, the people wanted to build a city and a building to hold the community together. I didn't see anything wrong about that, and nobody was jumping out of his or her seat to say, what are you talking about? This is terrible. It seems reasonable enough. God seems to think it's terrible, confounds the whole project, invents all these different languages on the spot, the people can no longer communicate. And this is why the town is called Babel, because God confounded them over there. What in the world was God so concerned with? Yeah.
Violation of the earlier blessing.
Oh, so very good. So one possibility is God blessed humanity, that we are supposed to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Well, if everybody tries to stay together, that is thwarting that. Okay, good. So that's one aspect of what we might be looking at. What else might be wrong here? If anything, yeah.
Huh?
It's the wrong place. You know, they chose wrong. Even though everybody lived in Babylonia, they should have gone to Jerusalem or something, right? Is that where you think the right place is? Good. And they should have bought Israel bonds. Okay, good. Okay, good. Oh, so you tell me. So the Rosh HaShemayim, the top is in the heavens. So what does that mean? I don't know either. Yeah, that's what I'm asking you. Oh. Oh, but why? Okay, it's so good. Let's work on your methodology because it's good. What's the assumption of what you just said? It's an assumption, but what's underlying it? Since God is concerned, it must be that something bad is happening here. So we need to look deeper than what the text seems to say. Now here we have a rule book problem. The rule book problem is that when you're trying to understand pshat in a text, pshat means the primary original intent of the author. And the running theme that our parshanim will tell us, that our interpreters will tell us, is you should be able to detect this in the text itself. Whether in this text or, what was done a moment ago, perhaps in some other text, such as a divine blessing to fill the earth. So at least it's somewhere in the Torah. So we can say, since these guys were trying to, or were thwarting God's blessings, God needed to do something about it. Now remember, this is the only story between Noah and Abraham. It's got to be really important. And somehow I'm feeling empty. Right? It's a real problem. This is one of the great interpretive problems of the Torah. Rabbi Goldberg may not remember just how much I wasn't allowed to teach Chumash in those days. Now I'm allowed to teach Chumash. It's so much fun. But I'm one of these rare Orthodox Jews who knows Nach way better than Ta. Just because I've been teaching it for so long. So now I'm finally catching up with my Chumash skills. It's really, really good. So it's a pleasure to be able to come and actually teach Torah also. The reality is, it's one of the most important stories in Bereishit, or at least it's positioned as such. Because right after this, God chooses Avraham Avinu to become the chosen people. Up until then, there's no chosen branch of humanity. God's working with everybody. And after this story, there's some kind of break. And God now switches over to one family that becomes, well, very important as far as Tanakh is concerned. Well, what makes that break? If all it is that they don't want to scatter and God had blessed them, I don't know. So make them scatter a little bit. But God's family's really alarmed over here, which is why your motivation point is so relevant. Right? It's so important to think about, there's got to be something big here, but I don't see anything big at all. Yeah.
That's
a very good. We're going to get to that. Your point is very well taken, and indeed we're going to get back to your point soon, because I think it's a vital importance. Let me frame your point differently for now, and then we'll get into the philosophy behind what you're saying in 15 minutes. Okay, the text part, which is relevant now, is why in the world is the Torah spending so much time talking about brick making? I mean, after all, the whole coverage of this community is 2 verses long out of the 9. One is, let us make bricks. Okay, let's say they use rocks. Would you care? Would I care? Would you care? It doesn't, what difference does it make? Let us build a city and build a tower, and whatever building materials they wanted to use would have been fine with me. The fact that the Torah emphasizes that might be relevant. And then we have one verse that explains their motivation, or at least why they're driven to build the city. And we have to get back to whether it has to do with the Rosh HaShemayim or something else in this verse, which is all critical. Okay, so what I'm trying to say here is that, bafflingly, here we have this really importantly positioned story, and yet it's very, very difficult to figure out what's going on. Yes? Oh, so it could be, let's just translate it loosely as they all speak the same language and they also are united in their purpose.
Right, so how do we know that means purpose?
You don't have to know. In other words, you can explore different alternatives, and if you could really nail one, then perhaps that might change the meaning of the story, right? But I don't think that there's any one good way to nail the meaning of that. It sounds like they are unified. They're all one community. They all are thinking the same thoughts, and they're all speaking the same language, and they all say, let's do this together.
Right, so the point that, from what you just said, that I think seems most relevant is when you said they're all thinking the same thoughts. The language doesn't automatically correlate to uniformity. There's unity with the language, but not uniformity. And having this second power, them speaking the same words, to me sounds like they also think the same way.
Very good. So, excellent point. And we're going to get, by the way, in case you're wondering this thing, whenever people say intelligent things, which everybody so far has done, usually, not always, usually these intelligent ideas have been anticipated, meaning that we're going to survey, all in less than an hour, we're going to survey the whole history of the last 2,000 years worth of interpretation and try to get a sense of the trends of thought. And one such trend is exactly what you are saying now. Right, and one such trend goes back to the technology point, one such trend goes back to the filling of the earth, and one such trend goes back to the heads in the heaven and the sky. Because everybody's trying to figure this out, right? In other words, that's what we have here. The Torah is giving us this commanding story of extreme importance, and yet there's some flailing around that needs to happen because it is so not clear. The Midrash says it very nicely. In the case of the flood, we all understand. Humanity was evil. Okay, we might not know exactly what things they were doing, but I'm sure, they were bad, and B, they were very widespread. I'm comfortable with that. I don't need to delve in with you and have a whole shiur about, were the people really bad? The answer is, the Torah is saying, yes, they were really bad. However so, it doesn't matter today. But in this story, I'm not at all clear as to, are they bad at all? Yet God seems incredibly alarmed. So let's take a couple more points and then we'll swing it into the 2,000-year survey thing. Yes. Oh, so you're jumping onto another part of the verse. Very good. That's yet another avenue that we can explore here. What does it mean to make a name for ourselves? I'm picturing that the biggest donor simply gets his name on the building. Right? And that doesn't have to be bad. It could be. I mean, some people are very, you know, over the top on that kind of thing. But many people, bless them. They want to be perpetuated. They understand that they're not going to live forever. But if they can be generous enough to donate a building or a piece of a building and be immortalized in that way, I think there's something very noble about it. On the other hand, you're right. If they're doing this because of arrogance, then that might be a problem in its own right. And that might be another avenue we need to explore. Okay. So one last thing. Somebody else had her hand up there, all the way in the back. Yeah. Very good. So that also, you very well might be right. I think it's in sync with what was just said about, you know, make a name for ourselves, that you want to zero in on that piece of the puzzle. That they're thinking too much about themselves and not enough about God. Now, I can't tell you no, because God is absent from their wavelength in this story. God shows up. He's very much part of the story. But they're not thinking about God in the text. And so maybe they're thinking of themselves, and maybe this is all part of this arrogant track that we want to explore. Okay. Huh? Very good. And I can't tell you no. It's one of these stories that every single thing that has been said thus far is not only excellent and conceptually relevant and I think religiously appropriate within the framework of the rest of the Torah, and it all might be here, but the emphasis is always going to be on the word might. Right, we're just not sure. And so what we need to do is let's survey interpretation for a little while, and then we'll try to weave in some of your comments, and I'm sure there will be other comments along the way. The Talmud swings into action in its very colorful way. The Talmud very often swings into action in a very colorful way, and this is no exception. This is in the Tractate Sanhedrin in what's called Perek Chelek. It's traditionally known as Perek Chelek because of the opening Mishnah, Kol Yisrael Yesh Lem Chelek L'Olam Haba. There's all kinds of amazing material in there. If you haven't read it recently, you got to go for it. Whatever you are in Daf Yomi or Daf Shavua or whatever you're doing, find a way to do Perek Chelek, because it's a wondrously amazing chapter. It contains all kinds of material. So here we are in source number 2. Rabbi Yirmiyah ben Elazar said, they split up into 3 parties, referring to the tower builders. One said, let us ascend and dwell there. They're actually trying to storm the heavens. The second, let us ascend and serve idols. And the third said, let us ascend and wage war with God. This is very colorful. And by the way, the advantage that they gain without any further ado, that's really bad. If that's what they're trying to do, then good. I understand why God is so concerned and tries to invent French. Like, he's going to have to do it because he has to stop them before it's too late. This is all terrible. They think they're going to invade the heavens and turn to idolatry. Oh, no, you don't, says God. Okay, at least they gain something immense by positing that this is all about idolatry. As the last line says, it has been taught, Rabbi Natan said, they were all bent on idolatry. The good news is, this explains why the Torah is giving attention to the story. It's not just about a building, it's not about holding the community together. These guys are turning to idolatry and rebelling against God. It's going deeper, some deeper motivation. And by the way, of all of the different interpretations that you've tossed out at me, all of which are excellent and all of which are here, what expression in the Torah is this Talmudic passage jumping on and saying, here's where the problem lies? Roshah b'shamayim. That its head is in the heavens. Now literally, if you're a Pashtan, what does that mean, that the head is in the heavens? It's a big building. Skyscraper, we still use words like this. We don't really think, I hope, that anybody's scraping any sky, but we use the expression because it sure does look that way. It's really cool, right? And so Moshe Rabbeinu refers to the Canaanite walled cities that way, that they have walls that go up to the heavens. Moshe Rabbeinu is not talking about anybody storming the heavens or worshiping idols. He just means you're about to face mighty nations, but God shall help you. Right? That's Moshe Rabbeinu's point. And that's all that it means here. It means let's build a big building. Okay. But the Talmud is taking this in its hyper-literal way to say it means literally the head is in the heavens. And that's what they're exploiting in this situation. They're trying to say that these people were actually trying to storm the heavens. So the good news is, that's really bad. The bad news is, you have to just ask it straight, is this really what the story is about? It's hard to say. I mean, did anybody see idolatry in this paragraph? Not a whole lot of it, right? And so you need Ibn Ezra to just say it his way. Ibn Ezra comes out fist flying. He says, you can't do this. Rashi, by the way, quotes the Talmudic passage and accepts it. But Ibn Ezra is not going to tolerate this. So Ibn Ezra swings into action in source number 3. The builders of the tower were not so foolish as to think that they could go to the heavens. Give me a break, he says. He's very blunt about this sort of thing. He says, if you tolerate this midrash as what the text actually means, if you tolerate it as a conceptually valid point, that's fine. Ibn Ezra has no bones to pick with that. But if you say this is what the text means, well, now you have the wrath of Ibn Ezra coming at you. And, you know, he lived, what, 900 years ago? I still am intimidated by him. I don't know about the rest of you. I feel like you feel his cold, harsh glare. And he's standing there pounding the table saying, you can't accept this. The people weren't so dumb that they think they're storming the heavens. The text reveals their intent. And here one of you posited exactly Ibn Ezra's reason. To build a large city for their settlement and a tower that would be a sign of their glory and also their location for the shepherds who ventured away. Just what I said at the beginning. They're building a building so people can see it as they stray further and further away from the hub. They would also preserve their name all the days of the tower. The builders hoped that they would never scatter, but this was not God's plan, and they did not realize that. In other words, it's all about pru urvu milu et haaretz. God blessed them to fill the earth. They had the best of intentions to build this town and this tower, but God didn't want it that way, so he thwarted them. So according to Ibn Ezra, what is the sin of these people? Nothing at all. Nothing at all. They didn't do anything wrong. It's just not what God wanted, so God stopped them. Now, the advantage of Ibn Ezra is, phew, all of our conversations where we're trying so hard to latch onto a word or two, Ibn Ezra says, stop it. There's nothing wrong with what they did. It's just simply not the divine blessing. That's the good news for him. The bad news is, what's the bad news for Ibn Ezra? There's always a good news and a bad news. It's a rare day that one interpreter swings in, gets all the good news and none of the bad news. Or else nobody would debate. Everybody would have noticed this in the first place, and we wouldn't have all these debates. There's always a pro and a con. The pro is, yeah, there's nothing about idolatry here. There doesn't seem to be anything negative in their intentions at all. That's the good news for Ibn Ezra. What's the bad news? Huh? And yes, the result of what happened, and even more dramatically, God seems to be very upset and threatened and concerned. If all it is that the people unwittingly are not fulfilling one of his blessings, God can take care of that. But it sounds like he's alarmed. It sounds, oh no, what are they doing? If I allow them to do this, they'll be able to do all that they want. What do they want? According to Ibn Ezra, they don't want anything. So it must be that there's something more. So this sets up an amazing phenomenon. Now somebody else posited the idea that there's a difference, quite correctly, between unity of purpose and uniformity. And so Ralbag in the 14th century suggests this possibility. He says the problem is that we all understand, isn't it good if we all get along and unity and all that good stuff? But Ralbag says that these people didn't just want a united purpose. That's fine. What they wanted was unity of thought, that everybody should think the same way. That's dangerous. God wants people to be different. He's done a very good job, by the way. But in the meantime, God wants people to be different. And so these people, by trying to build a tower in one united community where everybody's going to be together, it's again against God's blessings for humanity that we should be more diverse than that. So according to Ralbag, what is their sin? Nothing. He also doesn't think there's any sin here. But they're making a tactical error. Their game plan is different from God's game plan, and God is going to win. So Ibn Ezra and Ralbag are the opposite end of the spectrum here. no sin at all versus idolatry. Okay? It's amazing. We'll talk about a good range. Whenever you have a machloke, whenever you have a debate of this variety, you know what this tells you, by the way? We are so missing something. Right? If there's an opinion out there which Rashi espouses that there's idolatry going on, and the other opinion is no sin is happening at all. That's incredible. You don't see that every day. But that's why we're doing this topic and as opposed to some other one. Like we're talking about, these are the radical extremes that you could possibly think of here. So most of our commentators try to eat some cake and have it. They're not going to be able to eat all the cake because there's nothing about idolatry here. So they all abandon the Talmud on this one. But they have to assume that there is something negative because God is worried. And if God is worried, that means that somebody's doing something wrong. Okay, so what do? They simply latch on to what you've all said and they plug it into different possibilities. One thing is, they knew that God had blessed humanity to fill the earth, but they said, you know what, God, we're going to build this mighty tower and we're not going to fill the earth. We're going to rebel. That's how Radak takes it. And God says, oh yeah? French. Now they have to scatter. You're going to be blessed by me whether you like it or not. I've thought for years why I always put French in here, by the way, as opposed to say German. The answer is it has one syllable, so it still sounds to me like a lightning bolt. I was trying to figure out why I liked French in this context. But French, it sounds like a smite still is in play, which is good. It's a less painful one than your usual biblical smite. But all the same, I think that's why I liked that language to fit into that spot. I'm not really sure. That's where I think it's coming from. But in the meantime, so Radak simply takes Ibn Ezra's thing and turns it into a sin. That they were intentionally trying to thwart God. Other commentators, notably Nitziv, but others along the way also, say no, it's like Ralbag. They were a totalitarian society. They were trying to control everybody's thoughts. They weren't just naively thinking, oh, let's all think the same way, and then God doesn't want that. It's like, no. They knew what God wanted, and they didn't want that. They wanted to control everybody and oppress everybody. Tata Nitziv takes that, and of course, that is bad. It's not the same as idolatry. But once again, it doesn't sound like it's an oppressive society here. It might have been, I can't tell you no, but there's nothing in the text that suggests that they're trying to force anybody to think anything. Yeah?
In terms of something you said before about the bricks, we know that ziggurats were built of brick. Was the use of brick confined to religious structures?
To?
To religious structures.
I don't know if it was confined to religious structures. Your point is good anyway, and we're going to get back to your point anyway. I don't know if it was confined to religious structures. There aren't as many stones in Babylonia as there are, say, in Egypt. So I don't know if it's confined to religious structures or if people also built their homes out of it. I just don't know. Somebody probably knows the answer to this question. I'm not that person. But I can tell you a little bit about ziggurats coming up. Okay, a couple more things, then we'll move it along. Oh, but the question is, why is God rejecting these people? You're right. It sounds like God is really rejecting humanity after this story, which is why he shifts gears and goes over to Abraham. But the question is, why is that so? If they're turning to idolatry, I get it. Even if they're a totalitarian regime, I can really get that. But if they're just naively trying to not fill the earth because they want to stick together as a community, that doesn't really sound bad at all. It could mean that, and again, that's why Nitziv goes that route. No, that's why Nitziv goes that route. Everybody has something to stand on in the text. They're not making things up, but there's usually not going to be enough to pin it down and say, this is it. Okay, last thing, and then we'll pick it up, yeah?
Right. God said, let us. What does us mean?
Good question in general. It occurs a couple of times in the Torah, in very pivotal junctures, right? Let us make man. This one also, God is very concerned about, oh no, Adam and Chava just ate from the tree of knowledge and now they're like one of us. There are a couple of these plural-esque forms that appear in very pivotal narratives. There's somebody who published an article in 2006, his name is Lyle Eslinger, in one academic journal, I think it's 2006. But in the meantime, he tries to link these three instances together. These are three moments where humanity and God are battling over boundaries between God and people. Where God gives nobility to humanity, we're created in God's image, but God wants to make sure that we understand. God is God and we are not. And there are three stories here where this all plays out in some form or another, lending credence, by the way, to the arrogance theories that are floating around in this room. We'll get back to that. So that seems to be where it's coming from over here. But we'll get back to that. One opinion that really goes out on a limb here, And one of you suggested this before with the technology, is Abarbanel. Abarbanel says something that it's a consistent viewpoint of his throughout the Torah, throughout his commentary on the Torah, and I still can't believe it. But all the same, he says it, so I'll just tell you what he says, and you can either accept it or not accept it. Although if you accept it, your life will change very dramatically starting right now. So be prepared to face consequences if you accept this as the meaning of the Torah here. Abarbanel says the Torah is dead against all technology. And their problem is that they made bricks instead of using stones.
The Amish.
Huh?
The Amish.
Yeah, so this is much more than the Amish. I think the Amish still might use a brick here and there in the pinch, you know. They might not like electronics.
Oh, no.
This is all technology. Now, he says the same thing, by the way, with Cain and Hevel. Why did God accept, the classic question, why did God accept Hevel and not Cain? Because Cain had to actually use human creativity to grow crops, whereas Hevel just found some fuzzy sheep, took care of them, but they were in their pure natural-esque state. Now, this is astonishing that anybody can say that there's a problem with, say, growing, making bread, you know, grinding wheat into flour and letting it rise and going through a process, or making clothes. You know, the Torah doesn't believe that we all have to wear fig leaves, thank God. Or maybe not, because now it's so much more expensive. But in the meantime, however you want to spin that one, the fact of the matter is the Torah is certainly not against technology, and this is an astonishing philosophical position that Abarbanel espouses. The one plus that he gains big time in his interpretation is he is the only commentary that I'm aware of who cares about the pasuk about the bricks. Until you came along. You did a good job with that one. Right? Nobody talks about the bricks. They just ignore it and focus on Pasuk Dalet. Whether it has to do with we want to stay together, or whether the tower's top is in the heavens, or whether we want to make for ourselves a name, or whether we want to somehow that makes us, you know, conformist. Whatever it is, nobody else paid attention to the bricks. So Abarbanel, bless him, is paying attention to the bricks. But in the meantime, all I'm trying to say is I'm just as stumped as I was before I walked into the room with you. You know, okay, an hour ago or whatever it was, right? Hold on, yeah? Okay, so, sorry, two things and then, yeah.
Is there maybe something, like,
very good. And maybe there is something to what you are saying, and that would lend credence to the whole totalitarian, evil regime type of controlling thing, and especially if you can pile up more parallels, you'd have a lot going for you on that one. There are many parallels between Bereshit and Shemot in general. There might be more than enough to work with here, and that might really suggest that there was something pharaonic about what they're doing. It's certainly not explicit in our text. You would need to tease that meaning out, but all the same, that might give credence, yes.
Somebody dealt with all the opinions that might be offered.
Without going into the literal, not literal, which is a whole nother ball game, let's focus on your general premise of the ideological myth, or what I remember as a kid, some of you must have remembered Captain Kangaroo, right? And if you're a literature person, then you would think of Rudyard Kipling, but what do I know about him? I know much more about Captain Kangaroo, because I had this record that I listened to many times when I was about 4 years old called Just So Stories. Where Just So Stories, or the snazzy word for that is ideological myths, are stories that are created by later authors to try to explain today's reality. And the two just-so story pieces of our story, there are two things that this passage teaches us about the world that we live in. One is, why are there so many languages? And it tells you one other ideological point, which is?
Why are we all spread out?
Why we all live all over the place. Okay, that's even part of the same, but good. Why are we all over the place? And why is Babylonia called Babylonia? Right, in other words, here are some things that definitely emanate from the story. Even scholars who like this whole ideological myth thing are generally inclined to believe, as any traditionalist would believe, that that's true, the story definitely contains these elements, but that doesn't mean that that's why the story is here. There's certainly no question that literarily, to say that that's all the reason the Torah wanted the story to be here, I find that so very hard to believe. Yes, I'm a biased Orthodox rabbi here. I freely admit that bias, and I'm proud of the bias, what can I tell you? I find it very hard to believe that it's only that. And most scholars who focus on this ideological myth thing would certainly not say that, for the most part, would not say that this is all that it's about. So there's something more going on. The question is, what is the more? But your point is relevant. Your point is certainly true that it contains elements of explaining today's reality by looking backwards. Right? So good. That all being said, here's one of these funny scenarios. I like funny scenarios, where we have a black hole. Every one of the interpretations that we've put out there, from idolatry to no sin at all, everything in between, right? The idolatry thing really does not seem to be here at all, even though it would explain why God is so alarmed, but it's just not in the text. That they didn't sin at all, which makes me feel better because there's no compelling sin in this text, still doesn't seem right because God reacts very sharply. Then you have these middle positions. We've looked at three families of positions, right? Whether it's about technology or whether it's about totalitarianism or whether it's just about thwarting a divine blessing, whatever it is. But honestly, none of those things really seem very compelling at all. There seems to be something that we are missing. And so for 2,000 years, we've been bashing our heads over it. And it's not just traditional scholarship. Contemporary scholarship is also bashing its head over itself because it's very difficult to pin things down. So this brings us to what somebody else mentioned, the more recent times. We now move into ziggurats, which I learned about in sixth grade, and I'm sure I had to make some art project involving ziggurats, and that's pretty much the last I ever had to think about them, at least as far as my schooling is concerned. But in the 20th century, Umberto Casuto, none or his Hebrew name was Moshe David Casuto, grew up in Florence, Italy, and then came over and became the first head of the Bible department at Hebrew University when it was founded in 1925. Casuto was not only an expert in Tanakh, but he was really an expert in ancient Near Eastern scholarship of that time. I mean, obviously that scholarship has changed quite a bit in the last century. But all the same, whatever there was to know back in that day, he was quite on top of this stuff. And he was one of the first scholars to productively talk about the interaction between traditional scholarship and the text of Tanakh and what we can learn from the ancient Near East. He was way ahead of his time. Now, many more responsible scholars are at least in that methodology, even though, again, of course, the scholarship has significantly advanced. So here's Casuto's theory. He talks about ziggurats for a little while. He talks about Babylonia and their brickmaking and their ziggurats, right? Everybody built ziggurats if you were a Babylonian. They were brick temples, staircases, and the logic was the priests go up the staircases and the gods come down. Now, if you know anything about pagan theology, including Babylonian, the way the system goes is people were created to serve the gods. So it's a barter system. You give the gods meat because they actually are carnivorous and they actually do need to eat. So if you bring your sacrifices, the gods are now pleased and they give you rain, health, victory in war, children. It depends on which god you happen to be serving at this particular moment. That's how it goes. I hope it's okay that I'm talking about outright paganism in your shul. I apologize for that. It's required in order to be able to do this. You have to understand what the Torah is reckoning with and wrestling with at this moment. So then, what happens if you bring your sacrifices and it's still a drought? Those pesky gods just aren't giving you rain. So what do? If you're a good pagan, you go to your priests, and the priests do something like a rain dance or some other magical thing. What is magic? It's not just the cool stuff that I love at kids' birthday parties, and honestly, I wish somebody would do that at my birthday party. I love magic shows, right? Not that kind of stuff, not the sleight of hand stuff, but real black magic that pagans practice. The whole point of that is to go over the gods' heads, because there are forces of chaos that you can activate with your magic, and that forces the gods to give you the rain. That's why rain dances always work. Don't you know that? If it doesn't rain, that just means you did the dance wrong, right? But obviously if you... Okay, so I'm a little cynical about it, but that's how the system works. So according to this system, who is the most powerful force in the cosmos? Huh? The answer is the priests. Because they know how to activate these forces of chaos, and they can control the gods. That's what ziggurats are, part of that system. Ziggurats, you build the temple, and now the gods must come down. And the Babylonians were particularly proud of their biggest and baddest ziggurat of them all, which was in Babylonia itself. And it's called the Temple of Marduk. Marduk was the patron deity of Babylonia. And in Babylonian mythology, not surprisingly, Marduk is the one who ends up on top. Well, in Babylonia, the Temple of Marduk was called Estagila, which means Beit Yarim Rosh, the one that had the high head. And his tower was called Etamen Anki, or in Hebrew, Bet Yesod Shamayim Va'aretz, the foundation where heaven and earth connect. They were very proud of this temple. And they saw Babylonia as the center of the religious world. This is where all the gods center. This is where we can make them come. And of course, this is where we can get them to fulfill our will because we have magic. Well, you should know that this temple was found by archaeologists. This isn't one of these things that you see on the internet. You know, the usual archaeological news is you get something, some scholar claims to have found, you know, blah, 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 and there's a whole big splash about that. And then the next day, these scholars all say that's a bunch of hogwash, it's 500 years later, and actually it wasn't, you know, some incredible artifact from whatever, but rather it's just, you know, some nail from some pigsty or whatever it is. And then they fight about it for a while, and then we all go back to the sports pages. That's usually how these things go. Well, in this case, a German team of archaeologists found the Temple of Marduk in the late 19th century. This is old hat news, and Kasuta was well aware of it. And this thing was big. It was about 300 feet high, and it was a base of about 300 feet square. It's not all there. And honestly, that's not one place in the world that I care to visit. But all the same, the Temple of Marduk has been known and found for quite some time. The fact that it was found in the city of Babylonia tells Kasuto, that's the tower that Torah is talking about. It's talking about this Temple of Marduk, the great pagan shrine of Babylonia, the greatest of them all. Now, we actually have texts that Babylonians would read on their New Year festival and other solemn occasions describing this temple. And here we are in source number 4. Marduk, king of the gods, divided all the Anunnaki. This is after he defeated the old fogey gods and now is in charge of the universe. So he divided all the lower up gods. Above and below, the Anunnaki, who are gods, right? They're lower class gods, opened their mouths and said to Marduk, their lord, "Now, O Lord, you have caused our deliverance. What shall be our homage to you? We owe you big. You won the war against the bigger gods. What shall we give you? Let us build a shrine." When Marduk heard this, brightly glowed his features like the day. "Construct Babylon, whose building you have requested. Let its brickwork be fashioned." The Anunnaki applied the implement. For one whole year they molded bricks. Folks, this is incredible. It took a whole army of gods a year to make enough bricks to build this thing in Babylonian mythology. That is, talk about patting yourselves on the back, because obviously, last time I, you know, without having been there, all right, it was a bunch of slaves and whoever who built this thing, right? Like anything else. So, but of course the Babylonians didn't want to make it that way. They turned it into an army of gods, took a full year to make the bricks. Talk about focusing on brickwork here. They were very impressed with themselves. When the second year arrived, they raised high the head of Esagila, equaling Apsu. It was as deep as the deepest parts of the ocean. Apsu was one of the original two gods in the world, according to this myth. I was just filling that in so that you know who Apsu is. Okay, in the meantime, here's what we have. Babylonia, when they talked about their own temple of Marduk, they talked about it in the most glowing terms imaginable, understandably. They glorify it. They say that the gods built the bricks, and this is the greatest temple in the world, and this is where heaven meets earth. Well, according to Kasuto, and this story, but the temple of Marduk is much older than the Torah. It was from the time ballpark of Hammurabi, was a rough contemporary of Avraham Avinu. So this is long before Matan Torah. According to Kasuto, the Torah is shattering this well-known myth and saying this is a bunch of nonsense. First of all, who made the bricks according to the Torah? Well, people. Guess who? People made bricks. And now, of course, you understand why the Torah emphasizes the bricks. Because it's relevant. People who knew this myth would have said, oh, it's not the gods after all. The Babylonians have this completely wrong. People made the bricks of the tower, right? The Torah emphasizes that God swooped in and saw what was going on. Because God, of course, in the Torah is absolutely free. Not the gods of the pagan world. None of the gods of the pagan world are free. They're all tied to nature. And in fact, the forces of chaos can force them to do stuff. That's the whole point of a Zikkurat, that you could force God, the gods to come down. Well, not our God. Our God doesn't get forced to do anything at all. So the Torah is polemicizing against it. And then the kicker of the whole thing, I can't believe that in third grade they didn't ask this question, but you know, we were just happy enough to figure out why Rashi wrote in such funny little letters. Yes, I know Rashi didn't really write in what we call Rashi script. Let's carry on now. I don't understand why this wasn't raised in third grade or at least by ninth grade. Which is, why is Bavel called Bavel? Because they're confused. We all know that. That's what the Torah says. Now you see, here's the thing that nobody asked, at least not in my ninth grade. Maybe in your ninth grade you did better. You know, the Babylonians also called themselves Babylonia, right? And I strongly doubt, for even the slightest moment, they didn't think of themselves as very confused, did they? And that's because Babel doesn't mean confused. The Babylonians are the ones who gave themselves that name. We didn't give them the name Babel. So that's a fair point that Kasuto raises. It's right there in the text, and you realize, oh yeah, we're just reading the Torah's slant on this, which is these Babylonians are really confused. But why do the Babylonians call themselves Babylonians? And the answer is because Bab Elim, which is in Akkadian, their ancient language, means the gate of the god. Okay, now we're getting somewhere. Kasuto is suddenly opening up a world for us. Kasuto's point is that the Torah is mocking the Babylonians and their entire theology. The Babylonians think the gods made a tower? No way. People make towers. That's where it comes from. The Babylonians think that they can control the gods. Well, not this god. This god is not controllable. God is above nature. God is above human control. God is able to descend because God wants to. And why is Babel called Babel? So here's God speaking in the Torah saying, it's not because they're the gate of the god. I know a thing or two about that, says God. They're confused. They have it all wrong. That's what their name really means. God has confounded them. They're a bunch of confused people. So the Torah is mocking the ancient Babylonians and their theology. But wait a second. Oh, first of all, isn't that cool? I love this kind of stuff. I don't know about the rest of you. I think it's just grand when somebody, whether it's Kasuto or some other scholar, can show up. And actually, he's explaining the text that we have in front of us. He's not making up other stuff that now, okay, here's another theory that doesn't really match anything. No, he explains the bricks. He explains what's motivating them. He explains everything. And wait a second. Ding, 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 ding. I seem to recall that an opinion that was thoroughly dismissed by the whole last 1,000 years of commentary is the Talmudic passage in source number 2. Let's read it again, because boy, oh boy, suddenly it sounds very different. Rabbi Yirmiyah ben Elazar said, they split up into three parties. One said, let us ascend and dwell there. The second, let us ascend and serve idols. The third said, let us ascend and wage war with God. It has been taught, Rabbi Natan said, they were all bent on idolatry. Yes, they're right. This is all about idolatry. You needed Kasuto and his scholarship to fill in that gap. But all of a sudden, the Talmud has it black on white. Oh, here's a nice little tip. Where was the Babylonian Talmud written? These rabbis, when they went on their tiulim in high school, probably saw the tower. Right? They knew this culture. They knew what they were dealing with. They're not making this up out of fantasy land and imposing idolatry onto the text because they're looking for something that God is concerned about. They know this tower. They lived there. The tower is still, the pieces of the tower are still there now. Archaeologists have unearthed it. I don't know what... I don't think it was in use as a functional temple anymore, but I do believe that it was, you know, paganism certainly was alive and kicking at that point. It sounds like Chazal had some inkling into what this thing was about, that it was a pagan shrine rather than just a nice big building to hold the community together. They understood there's something more than that. I don't know if they knew this mythology that Kasuto's quoting. There's no way to know that. They don't quote it. Right? But the idea is, Kasuto's argument from the text that we have from the Babylonians is that this was serious paganism in play. And by the way, if you plug that in, Professor Yechezkel Koifman, who succeeded Kasuto at Hebrew University, he argues, that's what the Torah is so adamant about this story. This is the moment when idolatry is invented. Right? Which is critical. There is no idolatry in the Torah prior to this moment. People always get this one wrong. Avraham Avinu was the first blank. So when you're a kid, you learn he is the first Jew, and then at some point you get sophisticated and realize the word Jew is so anachronistic at that moment, it's just not right. Okay, so then you say he's the first monotheist, and you feel very good about that. But of course that's wrong, because who's the first monotheist? Adam HaRishon. It's very clear in the Torah that he wasn't a pagan. Adam HaRishon is the first monotheist. He's the first person, and he's engaged in a relationship with God. Paganism is an aberration. It's not that paganism, everybody was a pagan and Avraham Avinu discovered monotheism. That's not true, according to the Torah. Paganism is a later addition. Where did it come from? The answer is, according to this whole line of thinking, and according to the Gemara as well, right here, this is where paganism started. Well, now we understand why God is so alarmed. Because this is an outright rebellion against God. And when the entire humanity is doing that, that's when it's time to break rank with humanity and to choose one family who isn't like that. And to try to win the rest of humanity back. And of course, that is Avraham Avinu's job. Now, several of you pointed out the corollary of this. So the story is really about idolatry. But let's just push it one step further. Idolatry is not just wrong religion. It is wrong religion. Right? Yeah, they have a lot of gods, we have one. It's not just about the number of deities you happen to serve. The whole premise of the Torah is that since God is above nature and nobody can control God, there's a sense of humility. We have to know our boundaries. And that the Torah never ceases to emphasize this point. And the prophets also never cease to emphasize this point. Humility is all about recognizing our place. God is God. We are below God. We have great nobility in the image of God, but we're not a deity. Right? And we cannot be. No person is, no anything else is. That's critical as far as the Torah is concerned. Whereas pagans don't think that way at all. The gods themselves are restricted. And in fact, many of them, if you know any of the mythologies, are very human-like, aren't they? Right? And very often, people can trump over them in this or that conflict for that very reason. So the Torah is dead against that. That's part of what paganism is. Paganism, according to the prophets, is the supreme form not only of bad theology. That's not what bothers the prophets so much. What bothers them is that it is the supreme form of arrogance. If you think you can control the gods, and you think you're the highest force in the land, that's a disaster. That's what the Tower of Babel represents. And to some prophets, that's what all paganism represents, is supreme arrogance. One of the prophets who saw that very, very well is somebody named Tzfaniah, who doesn't get a lot of airtime in our day school curriculum on average, but he's very worthwhile. His dream, he hates all cities, just that you know, he really does. He thinks cities are just bad. He thinks Jerusalem is bad. He thinks Nineveh, which was the big city of that time, he thinks all cities are bad. So his prophetic vision of how is the world going to be better in the future, cities are going to fall apart and we're all going to watch sheep. So get used to it, because hey, if that's what Mashiach is going to take, I am willing to watch as many sheep as necessary. I'm sure you might be also. So Tzfaniah, that's his whole vision. His vision is that cities need to go. And his messianic vision, it's only 3 chapters long, his book, so here we are in chapter 3, source number 5. For then I will make the peoples pure of speech, that they will all invoke the Lord by name and they will serve him with one accord. What is this the antidote to? Yeah, this is it. This is the opposite of the Tower of Babel. In other words, now I'm going to get everybody united to serve God properly. They're all going to speak one language. In this case, it doesn't mean necessarily Hebrew, although some Mefarshim actually do interpret it that way. It means that we're all going to speak the language of serving God. We're all going to be united in that supremely noble purpose. That's how Tzfaniah understands it. You should know that we all follow the Babylonian, I shouldn't say we all, I don't know where you pray, but most of us follow the annual cycle where we finish the Torah reading once a year, following the Babylonian tradition. Well, in medieval Israel and Egypt and other communities, they had something called the triennial cycle, where they had to break up the Torah into 3+ years, and so they didn't have Simchat Torah, they didn't have any equivalent of Simchat Torah every year. They had it every three plus years. That's a triennial cycle. So of course, if you do that, each Torah reading on Shabbat is shorter, about 1/3 the length of what you and I experience on a weekly basis. It also means you have to pick a lot more Haftarot. It also means that the guys who sell those little flags for Simchat Torah are going to lose a lot of business and they should move to Babylonia, because then it's every year. Those flags never last. But in the meantime, the Haftarah in the triennial cycle for the Tower of Babel was this passage in Tzfaniah. They understood very, very well that this is the antidote to it. So Tzfaniah's vision of how the Tower of Babel needs to go is, everybody will serve God and be humble. From beyond the rivers of Cush, my suppliant shall bring offerings to me in fair Puzai. In that day you will no longer be shamed for all the deeds by which you have defied me, for then I will remove the proud and exultant within you. He understands it's not just about elimination of paganism, it's about the elimination of arrogance. Because that's what paganism is as far as the Torah is concerned. When you think you are the supreme power in the universe, you'll be haughty no more on my sacred mount. But I will leave within you a poor, humble folk, and they shall find refuge in the name of the Lord. Very nice. So what we have is that our story, if Kasuto is right, and I don't know, at least as of today, I'm still heavily convinced that he really is right. The Torah is trashing and mocking the whole Babylonian pagan system, which was the highest culture in the world, and the Torah is saying, these guys are totally confused. They don't understand anything about the nature of God. They don't understand anything about the nature of humility. They're so arrogant. They're so confused. They have it all wrong. This becomes the breaking point in why God needs to choose Abraham Avinu to leave Babylonia and to head on over to Israel to start a revolution, to try to win humanity over to something other than the Babylonian culture. Tzfaniah sees right on through what paganism is really all about. All the prophets do. I'm just quoting this because it's the real antidote to the Tower of Babel. That it's all about humility. Professor Yehuda Elitzur, Alav HaShalom, one of the great scholars of the previous generation, makes one final point. He says the expression of Babel, Bab Elim, in Hebrew, that means, well, the gate of the God, how would you say that in Hebrew? Shara Shamayim. Correct. That expression appears once in all of Tanakh. And that is, of course, Yaakov Avinu's classic dream with the ladder, right? Source number 6 over here. Vayirava yomar mano rama komaze en zeki im beit Elohim vezeh shara shamayim. So Yehuda Elitzur, who knows the whole shiur that I'm giving right now, because he read Kasuto too, he says, he has one little bonus here. He says, the Torah is saying, not only is Babel not the gate of the God, because they're just, it's all about human arrogance and the manipulation of the gods, that's so wrong, but you know where you find the gate of heaven? When you have a humble, righteous person. Wherever that person is, even if he's sleeping on a bed of rocks in the middle of nowhere, running away from his brother who wants to kill him, well, you know what? That's where you'll find the gates of heaven. You'll find the gates of heaven with righteous behavior, as Yaakov Avinu exemplifies here. So he says that this pasuk is deliberately coming to show the alternative to the Tower of Babel, which I think is a very good chop in its own right. So to wrap it all up for tonight, and I love how these shiurim go. I tend to get tired at night, but then I start, and then bless adrenaline, as we always say, and it's always better when people participate, so thank you. But then by the end, I'm like, man, let's go another 5 hours. You might not be thinking the same thought. Don't worry, I'm not even tempted. But in the meantime, usually by the end, I'm like, okay, now we're really raring to go, but I'll have to hold my fire for the coming week. But to summarize all of this, here's where, to me, there's a great example. There are many, where it's not about proving A or B using ancient Near Eastern scholarship, because I don't think that that's a productive avenue, or disproving. I don't think any of that's productive. What I think is productive is the use of sound scholarship, that's sound in its own right, and it interacts with what we have over here. In this case, we have a black hole, which we've known about for 2,000 years. Nobody could figure out what the story is so important about. And suddenly Kasuto swoops on in and says that, he doesn't say it this way, I'm saying it this way. The Talmud had it right all along. Right? That they were just saying what's really here, is just that we weren't able to see it without knowing what Kasuto brought to light in the 20th century. On that happy note, I thank you so much all for coming, and I look forward to learning with you for the next couple of weeks.